Greetings and salacious barrow vocations, my wintraciously trumbaric listeners, and welcome to this April 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this just plain trivial science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I'm in no mood to be charming tonight. This has been a very tiresome month. I have a feeling few would ever label me as charming anyway. So let's just get on with the first story of the evening. I think despite my lack of charming tonight, you'll appreciate that we do have some doozies of stories tonight. Doozy stories? Doozy... whatever. Okay, let's just get on with this. So the first story of the night simply proves that even when you win, you generally don't win. This is a very disturbing story because anyone who follows this podcast know I have been discussing this topic, literally, for years now. As you long-time listeners may remember, bisphenol A, BPA, is a chemical, a plastics ingredient, that is generally recognized as an endocrine disruptor. I have voiced concerns over its potential impact on human health for years. My voice and many others have prompted manufacturers to eliminate it from some consumer products. A few nations, including Canada and France, have even gone as far as to ban BPA completely from food packaging altogether. Recently, I have begun to discover that BPA-free on packaging does not necessarily mean free of all bisphenols. And as a pair of recent studies show that I came across, substitutes for BPA affect cells and animals in much the same way that bisphenol A does, or did. Of course, this is completely frustrating and angering. It's hard to get a handle on all the chemicals present in plastic products, but at least some BPA-free items contain, well, a BPA analog, such as bisphenol S or bisphenol F, BPS or BPF. These are replacements for the hardening agent BPA in plastic. How dangerous are these analogs compared to BPA? Well, Dr. Pascal Coumelieu of the University of Rennes in France and his colleagues measured the effects of four bisphenols on the brains of zebrafish. This was published last month, in March, in Frontiers in Neuroscience. Coumelieu found that three of four BPA analogs, BPAS, BPAF, and BPAF, are estrogenic, and they cause an upregulation in the brain of the enzyme aromatase. Now, aromatase converts androgens into estrogens, so in other words, male hormones into female hormones. Overall, these chemicals are similar to BPA in their effects on zebrafish. Coumelieu's group did not follow the fish's development long-term, but he said, quote, "If you affect the right balance of these hormones, we can speculate that there will be some problems, such as during the development of sexual differences in the brain. Boosting estrogen levels, for instance, can blunt the normal masculinization of the brain that occurs in males during development," unquote. Ah, but it's not just the brain. The physical body is affected as well. Dr. Ella Atlas of Health Canada published another study in March in the journal Endocrinology that looked at the influence of BPS on fat production. Exposing cell precursors from women to BPA and BPS chemicals led the cells to accumulate lipids and increase the levels of transcripts, RNA transcripts, indicative of differentiation into fat cells. Her experiments suggested that BPS acts through a fatty acid receptor called PPAR, which controls fat cell development. A number of environmental chemicals have been suspected of being obesogens, love that word, meaning that they cause weight gain and also activate PPAR. Yeah, all the problems that the West has with obesity may come down to our bad choices in packaging. Atlas said, quote, "It's impossible to extrapolate from my study how BPS affects people and whether it causes fat production in humans in vivo. But it's basically raising a flag that it may be a problem," unquote. So, BPA bad, but its analogs, BPF and BPS, may be just as bad. They may be making us fat and full of estrogens. Come on, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to fix this problem. Let's start a campaign to get rid of all bisphenol compounds and plastics altogether before it's too late. How long must this go on before we finally fix it? Yeah, like I said, a long month. I love the next story. What it mainly tells me is that people are ingenious. And the more dishonest people are, the more ingenious they seem to be. This is a science sort of story from the journal Lab Manager. Dr. Mohammed Al-Farouk, director of UCI's Advanced Integrated Cyberphysical Systems Lab, showed that a device as ordinary as a smartphone can be placed next to a 3D printer machine and capture acoustic signals that carry information about the precise movements of the printer's nozzle. So what, you ask? Who cares if you are recording a printer head? Well, here's the thing. What Farouk discovered is that these recordings can be used to reverse engineer the three-dimensional object being printed and recreate it. It's a completely new kind of cyber attack, and it presents significant security risks to the industry. Al-Farouk says, quote, in manufacturing plants, people who work on a shift basis don't get monitored for their smartphones. If process and product information is stolen during the prototyping phases, companies stand to incur large financial losses. There's no way to protect these systems from such an attack, but possibly there will be in the future, unquote. Al-Farouk's team achieved nearly 90% accuracy using the sound copying process to duplicate a key-shaped object in his lab. So he does indeed know what he's talking about. Al-Farouk says, quote, state-of-the-art 3D printing systems convert digital information embedded in source code to build layer upon layer of material until a solid object takes shape. A source file can be protected from cyber thievery with strong encryption. But once the creation process has begun, the printer emits sounds that can give up the secrets buried in the software. My group stumbled upon this finding as we were doing work to try to understand the relationship between information and energy flow. According to the fundamental laws of physics, energy is not consumed. It's converted from one form to another, electromagnetic to kinetic, for example. Some forms of energy are translated in meaningful and useful ways. Others just become emissions, which may unintentionally disclose secret information. Unquote. What does Al-Farouk suggest to fix this future horror of 3D cyberspying that will soon be visited upon us? Well, he says that engineers should begin to think about ways to jam the acoustic signals emanating from 3D printers, possibly via a white noise device to introduce intentional acoustic randomness, or by deploying algorithmic solutions. At a minimum, he says, a fundamental precaution should be to prevent people from carrying smartphones near the rapid prototyping areas when sensitive objects are being printed. Okay, all of that makes sense. I don't have a 3D printer yet, so I'm not really worried about spies out there. However, what about the next atrocious step, huh? What about my inkjet printer? Is nobody worried about recording the sound off that? I've got students who would dearly love to get a recording of my printing of my latest exams. Time to get Dr. Al-Farouk's white noise device, I guess. Oh, well. Next story. I remember when I took physics and chemistry a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. One of the absolute rules was you always have to have protons present in the nucleus. You can live with no electrons, but the presence of a proton sort of defines the nucleus itself. No proton, no nucleus. Well, it's taken a while, but some physicists finally broke that rule. They've created a nucleus that has no protons. The story came out in February, in the issue of the journal Physical Review Letters, and it came out of the lab of Dr. Kisamori of the University of Tokyo. If it's confirmed by further experiments, this tetraneutron would be the first example of an uncharged nucleus, something that many theorists say should simply not exist. It's already causing a sensation among physicists. The Japanese researchers spotted the signature of tetraneutrons after firing a beam of neutron-rich helium nuclei, 2 protons, 6 neutrons, at a liquid composed of the most common form of helium, which is 2 protons and 2 neutrons. Occasionally, the reaction produced beryllium nuclei with 4 protons and 4 neutrons, leaving 4 neutrons missing in action. Although the scientists could not see the other product directly, its properties fit the description of a clumped neutron quartet, as they call it. The 4 neutron nuclei lasted about a billionth of a trillionth of a second before decaying into something else. The physics community has made it clear that they will need to see more detections before agreeing that tetraneutrons exist. I guess I understand what their worry is. A lot of these results make no sense. If these tetraneutrons exist, then they are seriously puzzling because neutrons should not cluster in a nucleus unless there are protons there. There's nothing to hold them together. Remember, a neutron has no charge on it. I'm sure they won't like it, but nuclear theorists will probably have to propose some kind of new nuclear force to explain this really weird nucleus. I mean, how else are you going to explain it otherwise? Well, I don't know. I'm a biologist. What do I know? But that seems to me to be fairly apparent. Okay. Next story. Male mice without Y chromosomes. The horror. Once again, a story that suggests that we can do away with males and their stinky Y chromosomes. Who needs them Y chromosomes when we can make males without them, after all? Well, as it turns out, it's not quite that easy. Reproductive biologist Dr. Monica Ward of the University of Hawaii in Honolulu and colleagues started with mice that have only one X chromosome and no Y chromosome. And normally those mice would develop as females. But as Ward reports in Science last month, it did not quite turn out that way. At first, when I read the story, I was amazed. That is, until I realized that Ward's group was taking advantage of a developmental pathway that's been characterized for at least the last 10 years in humans. To put it simply, the Y chromosome triggers the process of male development. Oddly enough, there is a pathway in the non-sex chromosomes that completes male development. 2 Y chromosome genes, called SRY and EIF2S3Y, are crucial for male mouse development. SRY is a master gene that turns on male developmental programming in early embryos. It turns on a gene called SOX9, which then sets off a chemical chain reaction that leads to male development. The EIF gene is important for something else, as we'll see in a second. Basically, Ward short-circuited the system by taking out the SRY gene from the equation. She turned on SOX9 through other means. Activating SOX9 in a genetically female embryo will cause it to develop as male. But again, this has been known for a while because of genetic developmental anomalies that have been studied for quite a while over the last couple of decades. So Ward made males from females, but there was something crucial missing. Her XX males didn't make sperm. Their testes were essentially empty. Why? Remember I said that the EIF gene was important? Well, Y chromosomes are important for two reasons in terms of their function. One, the obvious one, is to induce male development. But the other reason is that you need the Y chromosome to make normal sperm. The EIF gene is one of the genes needed to make normal sperm. No EIF gene, no normal sperm. Ward tried to fix this by putting a copy of EIF on the X chromosome of their female. And it kind of worked. Only one copy of EIF on the X made immature, tailless sperm. She discovered it took up to 5 copies of the X version of EIF to do the same thing as 1 copy on the Y chromosome. Ward concluded with this, quote, "Our data indicates that the Y chromosome gene EIF2S3Y is a strong one. Some researchers have suggested that the Y chromosome is doomed and will eventually be lost. Our work does not support that the Y chromosome will disappear. On the contrary, it is very important for both development and sperm production, unquote.
Oh, so they're Y chromosome haters. Not going to get rid of it very soon, hater dudes, are you?
Next story. Another astronomic world record for the biggest rocky exoplanet yet discovered. Dr. Nestor Espinosa, an astrophysicist at the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile, reported the story January 28th online at the journal archive.org. When it comes to big balls of rock, exoplanet BD20594b might have all the other known worlds beat. At roughly half the diameter of Jupiter, BD is 100% rock. Kind of like the heads of some of the U.S.'s presidential candidates at the moment. Espinosa said, quote, "This planet defies calculation and all our previous conceptions of what large planets should look like. It is a complete mystery. A planet this large should be gassy," unquote. BD20594b sits about 500 light years away in the constellation Taurus. The planet is about 16 times as massive as Earth, but just a little over twice as wide, making its density about 8 grams per cubic centimeter. Earth's density, by comparison, is about 5.5 grams per cubic centimeter. This planet was discovered in 2015 with the Kepler Space Telescope, which looks for silhouettes of planets passing in front of stars. Neither Espinosa nor any other astronomer can explain how a solid planet this big can exist. But let me tell you, according to every old SF story I ever read as a kid, I would never want to meet up with a native of this BD planet, if there are any. A heavy gravity world like that would produce natives who are squat, wide, and literally as strong as elephants. Not very pleasant to come across in a dark alley down here. Next story. More environmental toxins and potential woes. For 3 decades now, doctors have prescribed more and more Prozac, fluoxetine, for organic depression. And it has probably helped millions of people to stay sane. One of the problems with all these people taking Prozac is that the drug is not completely broken down by the body. And what isn't broken down is urinated out. So for the last 15 years, we have seen an increase in the amount of background Prozac, both in drinking water as well as the water of rivers and lakes out there. Yes, it is in minuscule quantities, but it is increasing yearly. Dr. Teresa Zuakzinski and colleagues from the University of New England noted that the drug is turning up in our river systems. Thanks to its resistance to breakdown, it now seems to be affecting the behavior of aquatic residents, reducing aggression and risk-taking, and affecting how often animals feed. This is very bad news for our ecosystems. Zuakzinski's findings for the effects of Prozac on fish behavior were published in last month's Journal of Experimental Biology. She decided she wanted to find out how male Siamese fighting fish that had not been exposed to fluoxetine and those that had experienced a week-long, low, or high dosage responded to situations that were designed to challenge their courage and how their reactions changed over time. Right from the start, it was clear that the fish that had not been exposed to fluoxetine were much keener to explore a novel empty tank than the fish that had been swimming in water laced with antidepressant, and the fish that had received the highest dosage were the most timid. However, the fish that had been exposed to 0.5 microgram per liter of the drug were bolder on some occasions than others, and when the team tested the fish's reaction to an unfamiliar tank furnished with intriguing stones and plants, or the presence of a shoal of lady Siamese fighting fish, the two sets of drugged males were equally disinterested in exploring,
The strength of the drug apparently did not affect them differently. Zuakzinski, he says, quote, perhaps most importantly and alarmingly, the effects of exposure lasted even after Prozac was removed. Even brief periods of exposure could potentially produce chronic effects, especially as boldness is important in migration, aggression, and predator evasion, unquote. This is not good news. Now not only are we giving male sea creatures increased levels of estrogen with bisphenol compounds, but messing with their inherent maleness by giving them Prozac. Of course, global warming is not exactly helping. Frankly, I will be amazed if any ecosystem in the world is going to survive the next 50 years at the rate that we are sabotaging ourselves. Sorry, I don't mean to be such a worrywart, but it's just pathetic that we are doing our planet in this way. Last story of the night. When is randomness no longer random? Well, apparently when you're looking at prime numbers. Mathematicians Drs. Kannan Sundararajan and Robert Lemke Oliver of Stanford University stunned themselves last month by discovering a pattern in prime numbers. Apparently, this is not something that anyone ever expected. If you remember your grade school math, prime numbers are those that are divisible only by themselves and one. But they are also the building blocks of all other numbers which are created by multiplying primes together. Clearly, prime numbers are fundamental to arithmetic, and this is why mathematicians are constantly trying to decipher their mysteries. Mathematicians have no way of predicting which numbers are prime, so they have been treated as if they occur randomly. Sundararajan said, quote, it is very weird. It's like some painting you are familiar with, and then suddenly you realize there's a figure in the painting you've never seen before, unquote. So what'd they find? Aside from 2 and 5, all prime numbers end in 1, 3, 7, or 9, since they can't be divided by 2 or 5. If the numbers occurred randomly, as expected by mathematicians, it shouldn't matter what the last digit of the previous prime was, since each of the four possibilities should have a 25% chance of appearing at the end of the next prime number. It turns out that's not what's happening. While searching through the first 100 million primes, the two mathematicians noticed that primes ending in 1 were followed by another one ending in 1 just 18.5% of the time, something that would not happen if the primes were truly random. Worse yet, primes ending in 3 and 7 each followed 1 a whopping 30% of the time, while 9 followed 1 about 22% of the time. The patterns become more random as you count higher. The team actually developed a computer program to search through the first 400 billion primes, but the pattern still persisted. So where does this pattern come from? Sundararajan and Oliver think that they have an explanation which they call the K-tuple conjecture. This conjecture was developed by mathematicians from the University of Cambridge in the early 20th century as a way of estimating how often pairs, triples, and larger groups of primes appear. Using the K-tuple conjecture, the team showed that the groupings given by the conjecture were responsible for the last digit pattern. However, they also found that as the primes stretched to infinity, they completely lost the pattern and followed the random distribution mathematicians are used to expecting. Okay. I don't entirely understand that, but and again, that's why I did not become a mathematician. Sundararajan finishes by saying, quote, we do not think this discovery will have any immediate implications in the world of mathematics, but it has left some mathematicians a little shaken. It gives us more of an understanding of primes, and every little bit helps. What worries us, though, is if what you take for granted is wrong, that makes you rethink some of the other things you know. It turns out that you should be very careful when you make assumptions, even when everyone agrees with those assumptions. Unquote.
Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Support that ban on bisphenols from plastics. Remember, the Y chromosome is still relevant. Don't let anyone record your printer. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Capitella.